Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, bringing you conversations that matter and a bit of a different one this week, a variety of interviews that I think you're going to enjoy. So I'll tell you all about them in just a moment's time. Glad to say we've seen a lot of bookings coming in the past week for our online conference, Saturday the 15th of May, unbelievable.live. Learn how to tell the greatest story ever told. We are so looking forward to welcoming people like N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, Sean and Josh McDowell on that day. You can be part of it too. There's going to be Q&A throughout the day, loads of great interactivity, a 3D resource hub, and much more besides. And you can even pay what you want. We've got a premium ticket with lots of bonus stuff where you get all of the conference material on high definition afterwards and more besides. But you can also do the pay what you want option, and at a time, hopefully, that will suit a lot of people out in the US as well. On Saturday, the 15th of May, if you haven't booked your place, the place to go is unbelievable.live. Well, no feedback on today's show because we're going a bit long, squeezing in three interviews on today's show. It's going to start with me catching up with Alistair McGrath, Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University, with his reflections on the recent passing of physicist priest John Polkinghorne, whose writings and ministry have been so influential in the field of science and faith. I will also be hearing, as part of that, a sneak preview of a new C.S. Lewis podcast that Alistair is contributing to and that'll be released in just over a week's time. In the second part of this week's show, Ruth Jackson catches up with Shelby Abbott. He's author of a new book called Doubtless, Because Faith is Hard. And then in the final part of the show, it's back to me in conversation with Mark Clark, pastor of the Village Church Vancouver. And Mark has a great new book out as well called The Problem of Jesus, Answering a Skeptic's Challenge to the Scandal of Jesus. So there'll be links to all of those resources with the show notes in the podcast or at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, our webpage. A real smorgasbord of interesting people and topics on today's show. Hope you enjoy it. And we'll begin with this reflection on the life and legacy of John Polkinghorne.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, joining me on the show now is Alistair McGrath from Oxford University, and he's here to talk about theologian and scientist John Polkinghorne, who died recently at the age of 90. Alistair, welcome along to the programme. Tell us a little bit, firstly, did you know John? Did you spend much time together during the course
of... Yes, I did get to know him quite well. In fact, I got to know him back in 1979, and the circumstances are actually quite interesting because I was then training for ministry in the Church of England, and we heard this bombshell announcement that John Polkinghorne, a professor at Cambridge, had resigned his chair to begin training for ministry at the Church of England, and he and I were fellow students at the same institution training for ministry together. We got to know each other because both of us had interest in science and religion. So, in fact, he used to be known by some of his students as Polky Dot, not Polkinghorne, Polky Dot, because he'd quite often wear a rather snazzy polka dot tie, which I was very impressed by.
That's brilliant. And so you first of all knew him, obviously, as a physicist. So tell us a little bit of what you know about his career up to that point before he made this rather shocking announcement he was going into the church. What was his area before that?
Well, his area really was mathematical physics, and he was, I suppose, quantum theory is the easiest way of describing what he was doing. And he simply achieved eminence very, very quickly. But as he himself, once said, you know, the problem is if you're a mathematician, you peak when you're about 45. In other words, all your best work is behind you. And I always had the sense that John felt that it was time to make a break and do something new. And actually, he did that in a remarkable way.
Yes. I mean, what particularly were his sort of, what was his the nature of his work? What were perhaps some of the things he really contributed to when it came to theoretical physics and so on?
Well, I think there are a number of things that people will single out as being particularly important. I think that people will in effect say that he'd be very, very well remembered for developing the kind of agenda you find with Paul Dirac and people like that. And it's actually very difficult to summarize this briefly for a lay audience. But what I would say is that Paul Kihorn really did establish himself as a leader in the field, developing this theme, these themes about the mathematical representation of reality. And that, of course, is a leading theme in his writing on science and religion. But another thing which I see him picking up from this period is this very strong sense that if something is beautiful, there's a good chance it's going to be right, you know, with scientific theory or indeed a way of thinking about reality such as that offered by Christianity.
That's great. In terms of his Christian faith, was that something he had sort of from childhood, as far as you're aware? Was it something he embraced more, you know, as an adult?
Well, John was a member of KICU, the Cambridge Intercollegiate Christian Union, and that suggests he was committed, that he would have been towards the evangelical end of the spectrum. And of course, his wife, Ruth, who he met while he was at Cambridge, was also a member of the KICU. So they're both mathematicians. So obviously they formed a rather nice friendship, which of course lasted until her sad death some time ago. But I would say that John had a real commitment to the Christian faith, not just sort of nominal commitment, an active commitment. And actually, looking back at some records I came across about students at Cambridge back in the early 1950s, John would have hung out with people like Charles Coulson and others who in effect were very, very engaged in this question of how on earth you held together your science and your faith. So if you like, it's not just he was very active as a Christian, he was very concerned how do you hold together issues of science and faith. This goes way back to the middle of the 1950s.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. So he would have been at Cambridge around the time C.S. Lewis was there as well. Do you know if their paths ever crossed, or is that?
He never talked about that. I have to say that there are points when I lecture on Paul Kihorn where I say I see a similarity with Lewis, and I see it in several ways, one of which is accessibility, and another is something which hasn't been made of enough has been said about this, really. I think it's that he's actually very, very good at answering questions ordinary people were asking. But I don't think I saw any real relationship with Lewis. Certainly he read his books.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, at the time John was doing his physics, you know, and really in that area, was there the sort of battle that we've seen in more recent years, you know, the supposed contradiction between science and faith? Was that something people were talking about even back in the 50s when he was doing his science?
If you talk to students at Cambridge in the 50s, they will say that the kind of the default position was that science and faith were incompatible. So there was a sort of sense of this. Now, actually, John did mathematics as his first degree and then switched to physics for his doctorate. So I suppose you could say as a mathematician, he was kind of in a slightly different place. But certainly the intellectual environment was that science and religion were just not things that a thinking person could hold together, which is why actually it's quite interesting. That's how John would meet up with other Christians who were scientists to try and figure out how best to do something about this. So if you like, maybe they were huddling together for intellectual warmth, but they were also trying to work out how on earth can we deal with the questions our culture is asking about the relation of science and faith.
I mean, it's interesting that ultimately he felt this call to go into ministry specifically in the Anglican Church. Many people might have felt you're best off sort of staying within the scientific community and making your influence there rather than sort of moving out into essentially pastoral ministry and all the duties that are involved with an Anglican parish. So what was behind his reasoning for doing that?
Well, others had done this before him. You see, John Hapgood was a Cambridge research scientist who actually left science behind after his doctoral work because he felt science wasn't very good at engaging the real questions ordinary people were asking. Now, John stayed in the in the academic world for much, much longer. But I think actually there are two things I do notice from his writings. One is a sense my best work is now done. Why not go out on a high? But also this sense that he felt he had something that he could offer in a different field. In other words, he thought a lot about science and religion. He hadn't published really anything. He began to publish in the 80s, but he clearly had been thinking about this. My own guess from conversations we had is that actually he saw a pastoral ministry as being very important in terms of service, but not just a pastoral ministry, but also an intellectual ministry to try and help others who were troubled by the same questions as he was.
So in that sense, did he see himself as, I suppose, taking that the whole area of science and faith into the public domain, especially to other Christians? He felt he could do that more effectively through this vocation of priesthood.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I have to tell you that I felt he was making a mistake by going into parish ministry. Look, he was a Cambridge professor. He ended up serving as a curate in a small church, and then he went and served as the incumbent of another small church. And if you talk to anybody who's an incumbent, they are overwhelmed with administrative work. So I felt, is this really right? But what I would say is that it's absolutely clear that he's able to use that time to develop the skill of being able to speak to ordinary people coherently and passionately. So what you could say, I guess, is that his time working in parishes made him learn the language of ordinary congregations and deal with questions they were asking. Now, we know that from his own writings that John did not see himself as having any intentions returning to the academic world. He really saw himself as going into ministry, and that's what he wanted to do. But of course, his friends at Cambridge had other ideas, and they said, it's time to come back.
And what did that return look like, ultimately? I mean, obviously, he did spend a certain amount of time in local pastoral parish ministry. What did his return to some form of academia look like?
Well, he did. I mean, basically, his final parish ministry was in Kent, in a rather nice parish near Canterbury. But obviously, Cambridge needs chaplains, it needs deans of chapel, and he was a known name. And eventually, the suggestion was made he should come back to Cambridge as Dean of Chapel at Trinity Hall in Cambridge. So after a couple of years in parish ministry in 1986, he went back to Trinity Hall. And he went back, I have to say, to do a role which would have involved more interaction with students than with ordinary people. But nevertheless, I think that he had clearly learned some skills in the parishes that he was able to bring to that short period of ministry at Trinity Hall. And then what happened next was that, as you know, every Oxford and Cambridge college has a head of house, and what they're always looking for is somebody who's academically serious but actually has wider gifts. And so John was asked to become president of Queen's College Cambridge 3 years later in 1989, and I have to say that's a remarkable achievement. So actually, I mean, when he retired from that in 1996, he basically had a glittering academic career. He had been a professor at Cambridge and head of house, and that's very significant.
Yes, quite extraordinary. What would you say, were his was his influence at that time, obviously having that significant oversight of both the student body and the academics as well at Cambridge?
Well, John was a diplomat and a pastor, and so actually that came out quite clear in his dealings with people. And I think, having talked to people who served under him during his time, particularly at Queen's College, the memory of him is of a warm-hearted, pastorally concerned person who everybody knew was academically very, very good, but actually came across simply as a rather nice person. I think that's a rather, rather nice tribute to be able to pay to him, I think. But of course, at the same time, he was very, very active in the field of science and faith. And I would say that by 1990, he was the go-to person. You know, in effect, you know, if you want to talk to somebody serious about science and faith, he was the person you would ask. And I think there were two things that really came out very, very clearly. One was that he had this very accessible speaking style. Now, that may, again, be the result of his time in parish ministry, where he learned you had to speak in a certain way. But it was also, I think he almost intuitively knew the questions people wanted to talk about and had answers for them, which I assume he had worked through himself, both in his time as a student and then, of course, in parish ministry. So he was a very, very able person. The other thing to say, of course, is that John was very orthodox as a Christian theologian. And in the field of science and religion, you had other people like Ian Barber in the States or Arthur Peacock here in the UK, who actually were much more liberal in their approach to theology. And John felt, you know, in effect, he was traditional. He believed in the incarnation. He believed in the Trinity. He was very, very clear about the importance of the Bible. And he could see ways of weaving these all together in terms of science and faith. So the sense in which an awful lot of people trusted him because they felt this man is on the same page as me. I can listen to him.
Yes, absolutely. And when it came to the ways he put that across to a lay audience and to his scientific peers, how did he put the science and faith together? You know, so when the person, I don't know, sitting around the high table at Cambridge would say, John, how can you, as a man of science, possibly believe that a man came back from the life to from death to life in the resurrection? I mean, what sort of an answer would you expect John to have given at that point?
I haven't heard him answer that question, I have to say, but he does touch on it in some of his books. And basically his argument is, look, you cannot actually predetermine what history is, what did happen. You have to kind of figure out what was going on. But his basic approach, which I think is very, very sensible and very, very accessible, is to say, look, science and Christianity are different ways of trying to make sense of our world. They do it in different ways, but actually they're doing the same job, and there are points of overlap between them, and you welcome these points of overlap, but nevertheless you retain the distinctiveness of both science and Christianity. I think for me, one of the really important things here is that there's been some research work done which shows very, very clearly that when people are trying to work out whether science and faith are compatible or not, they tend not to think about the ideas on their own. They tend to think of people who manage to hold them together. And they'll say, well, look, if he or she can do it, I can do it too. And of course, John Polkinghorne, if you like, was a living exemplar of somebody who was able to hold these together. And people would say, well, look, he's intelligent, he did it, maybe I can do it as well.
And we do need those kinds of examples, don't we? I think that's partly why people like Polkinghorne, and I dare say yourself as well, as to have been an inspiration to many people, because you've been able to hold being rigorous in terms of your science with being absolutely orthodox in terms of your Christian faith, and not seeing that there's a contradiction between the two of those. I suppose, was John in any way an inspiration for your own sort of journey, you know, in science and faith? And of course, you yourself were ordained at one time. I can't remember exactly when that was, though. So was it at a similar time, or obviously a bit
John
later on?
John and I were ordained roughly around the same time. That's right. I was a little bit earlier than him. But when I went back to Oxford to start teaching, which is in 1983, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was find ways of holding together science and faith. And I wasn't teaching in that field. I was thinking about it. And it took me a long time to get to the point where I felt I could teach in the field. But I read Polkinghorne's first book in this field, The Way the World Is. I think it came out in 84. I think I may have read it about a year or two later. But when I read it, I thought two things. A, this man knows what he's talking about. And B, he writes so clearly. You know, I just thought, you know, if this guy keeps going, and he did, of course, he published rather a lot of books. You know, I just thought this is very significant. And in fact, just checking my own books in response to thinking about John, I quote him a lot, I have to say. And the reason I quote him a lot is because he's so good, so accessible. He's the kind of person who gives you a beautiful quote you can put into a book, and it kind of way lightens up the text a lot.
What kind of particular things did you find he helped to illuminate? I'd be interested to know, for instance, whether how he put together his obvious admiration for the universe and the nature of it, cosmology, the big man cosmology that was obviously kind of coming, you know, developing significantly over the 50s and 60s as he was really at the center of his scientific career. Did he see that in some ways connecting strongly with a God hypothesis? What was the way he put things together in that sense?
John's approach was that of a scientist rather than a theologian. And so if you're a scientist, you're saying, what is the theory that actually makes most sense of things? You might use criteria like simplicity or comprehensiveness. And one of the things that John would regularly say, both in his talks, but also in his published writings, is that an Orthodox Trinitarian faith gives you this way of looking at the world, which actually fits all these things in. It's intelligible, it's comprehensive. And for popular one, this was just a very important resonance between Christianity and the way the world is. He uses the word congruence a lot. If you like, the world is congruent with what Christianity thinks it ought to be. I tend to use the word resonance more, but that's because I come from a different form of science than he does. But nevertheless, he's absolutely right, and he really developed that point. Another thing he said, which is really helpful, is that science raises a lot of questions it can't answer using its own methods. And he therefore would in effect say that we have an opportunity here to show how Christianity can answer these questions, which are rightly asked by science, but actually they can't answer by themselves. So he was very much in terms someone who invited scientists to think about the limits of their own disciplines.
And you say he was also invested in the idea of the beauty of science, in the sense of the beauty of the theories, you know, that explain the universe. He evidently felt there was some congruence between this beauty and the idea of a God who creates in beautiful ways.
I think that's right. I think one of my concerns has always been that certain forms of science are very, very rationalist. And it's all very interesting, but it's a bit dull. And what do you do with the beauty of the world? And John found a way of doing that. And actually, it's really drawing on this idea that beauty is an indication of truth in a deeper sense of the word. And actually, I welcomed that because I've always been concerned that science often presents itself as a very abstract, very dry, very arid, very reductionist view of the world. And John found a way around that. And actually, his Christian faith gave him a framework to be able to celebrate and interpret the beauty of the world.
You've been involved in a few debates with other atheist scientists over the years yourself, Alistair. What was John's approach? Did he kind of go in for sort of invitations to debate people? What was his sort of the way that he tended to do dialogue and so on?
John is much more a person who tends to write about his own views, engaging in dialogue with other people. I don't think he saw himself as a debater. I think that debate is not always the most academically satisfying form of things. Very often you find that the person you're arguing with just doesn't want to engage you. And it's very, very frustrating. I think John felt that a positive, constructive articulation of the Christian faith in many ways was its best defense. And that actually may be part of his legacy, that as I read his books, I see this constant returning to the basically saying, here's what Christianity is, here's the difference it makes, here's why it's so interesting to a scientist. And he does criticize people who kind of adopt a very reductionist atheist approach. But actually that is incidental, that the main thrust is, here's Christianity, it is so good in this way.
He was knighted, I think, in 1997. What was that? What particular services was that he was being recognised for?
Well, I think he actually did a lot of public service alongside his role as an academic and various things. He served in on various committees in public life. He served also as a trustee of some very significant charities. And I think that basically, there was a very, very clear case for rewarding him in some way. But of course, we never called him Sir John, because if you're an Anglican clergyman, you just don't do that. OK,
well, and there were other accolades, obviously, down the line. He won the Templeton Prize as well in the early 2000s. What though, now, as we look back on his life and give thanks for it, what would you say are the things that will continue to inspire people, that will continue to influence people from the things he did and said and wrote in his own lifetime?
Well, let me mention two, if I may. I'm not going to single out particular books, but two themes that I have noted and appreciated in his writings. One is that he's not a polemicist. He is, in effect, a very clear writer who is, in effect, saying, let me tell you the way it is. And actually, we can all learn from that. You know, that actually, very often, the best defense of something is not to shoot down your opponents, but it's rather to say, here is what it is. And I think I've learned from that. But the other thing, which I think is very important, is that this man obviously understood people. That actually, you know, I guess this is due to his parish ministry, but certainly he knew the questions ordinary people, ordinary Christian believers were asking, and he answered them in terms they could understand. He scratched where they itched. And that's the mark of someone who has, in effect, taken other people very, very seriously and said, here's what I've found helpful. Does this help you? And I think that's a mark of someone who, in effect, takes other people very seriously indeed.
Well, let's hope that, I'm sure it already has, but let's hope that many more people take up that mantle of putting science and faith together in the gracious way that John did. You've written kindly a tribute to John for Premier Christianity magazine. I will leave a link to that with today's show so that people can go and read it there as well. There's some other exciting news on the horizon, though, before you leave me, Alistair, which is that we're going to be beginning a new C.S. Lewis podcast that you're the regular contributor to soon. It is due to start on Monday, the 29th of March. And that's one recorded with our own Ruth Jackson on a regular basis. We've actually had this waiting in the wings for a little time. Coronavirus sort of put it in the on the back burner for a while. But we're really looking forward to this. Because there are obviously a number of podcasts out there that deal with C.S. Lewis in some ways. This is the first time, really, though, that we've got sort of Alistair McGrath, one of the key people on C.S. Lewis, sort of sitting down regularly with us to talk through his life and faith. What do you hope people will gain from if they're able to tune in and download the podcast over the next few months?
I hope they'll just come away feeling, hey, C.S. Lewis is really interesting. I need to go and read this guy. And if that happens, I will be so pleased.
Absolutely. Well, I've had the pleasure of being able to listen to some of the episodes in advance, and they really are worth listening to. If you want a sort of an in-depth piece, but also very accessible on C.S. Lewis, then do tune in for that. We'll make sure there are details from today's show as well, where you can go and get yourself registered so you can make sure you don't miss a thing. For now, Alistair, thank you very much for being with me and for sharing your thoughts and memories of John Polkinghorne. For now, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And you can find Alistair's written tribute to John Polkinghorne at the Premier Christianity website. I'll include the link with today's show notes. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But just before we move on, we've got a little sneak preview of that C.S. Lewis podcast that we'd love to share with you. It's a new show hosted by my colleague Ruth Jackson. It's coming out in just over a week's time. Have a listen to this. The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Do you think C.S. Lewis would have an Instagram profile?
His friends might set one up, but I'm not sure Lewis himself would. I think that Lewis is always receding into the background. Lewis is very, very clear about what does a good author do, he said back in the 1920s. He says, a good author does not say, look at me. He says, look at what I've seen. And for Tolkien, we are almost designed by God to tell stories. And Tolkien began to help Lewis see that really Christianity told a story, the story of God, the story of Christ, our story. And Lewis suddenly began to realize how everything hung together, how everything made sense, and that if he thought of Christianity as a story, a true myth, which makes sense of every other story we tell, then that makes perfect sense. And he writes to Arthur Greaves in enormous excitement, this is it, I've discovered it, it's right, it's exciting. And that's a very important point. And maybe Lewis might have got there on his own, but actually Tolkien was the catalyst. I first read The Chronicles of Narnia when I was about 22. Yeah. I have to say, I actually rather enjoyed them, maybe because I'm very childish, I don't know. I think for Lewis, there were a number of objections. One was that he felt that science had eliminated the conceptual space once occupied by God. Another was he thought there was a sort of similarity of form between Christianity and pagan myths, which meant they were all inventions. And then thirdly, there was this anxiety about suffering in the world. So those were three major concerns for him. But as his story of faith shows, he was able to overcome all of those.
if someone is thinking, how do I begin to defend the Christian faith? Have you got any advice that you would give?
I would begin by saying, let me tell you why I find Christianity so compelling and exciting. And then I would tell them. And everyone listening to this podcast will be able to do exactly the same thing. And in doing that, you're telling your own story. And your audience will be interested. They may want to raise objections, but they're going to hear you first. They want to hear the positive, then they'll raise questions. The problem is, otherwise, you just raise questions, and people don't know why those questions are significant. You need to explain why this matters, why it's so exciting, and then deal with the questions.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? If you enjoy C.S. Lewis, if you like Alistair McGrath, if you enjoy Unbelievable, frankly, then I think you're going to love this new podcast. Releases on Monday, the 29th of March, so look out for it there. You can register as well to make sure you receive news about it at the show page we've put together for it too. That's available with the show notes. But again, that's coming up in just over a week's time. Ruth Jackson is here talking to Shelby Abbott next about doubt.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable, a real smorgasbord of topics and guests for you today. Later on in the show, I'll be talking to Canadian pastor Mark Clark about his new book about Jesus for Skeptics. Not much time for your feedback today, I'm afraid, but if you'd like to get in touch about anything you hear on the show, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can get hold of us via our social media. There are links from today's show for all of that. And of course, you can keep in touch with the show via our newsletter. You can sign up from our webpage. Again, links from today's show or at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Now, doubt is a pretty universal phenomenon, and there's been plenty of stories of Christians falling away because of doubt in the last year or two, not least the story of Rhett and Link, well-known YouTubers who went public just over a year ago with their deconstruction story. Well, Ruth's next guest, Shelby Abbott, knows them, as at one time they worked together for the student evangelism movement Crew. So what does Shelby have to say about doubt and deconstruction? Let's find out.
I am here today with Shelby Abbott, who works for Family Life, which is the sort of family ministry of Crew. And he is also an author of numerous books, including his most recent book, which is called Doubtless Because Faith is Hard. Well, it's so nice for you to be with us today, Shelby.
Thanks for having me, Ruth. I appreciate it.
Well, I guess the first question would be, what was the motivation behind this book? It's got quite a clever sort of title, hasn't it? Doubtless, Doubtless.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of this, marketing strategy to it's talking about doubt, the subject of doubt. And then in the process of going through that, you can become doubtless to doubtless. So it's a little play on words. But yeah, that was one of the things that I was processing and thinking and feeling. I have a struggle with that specifically through not necessarily believing whether or not God is real, but believing whether or not he's good, if he's sovereign, those kind of things. I'm a chronic pain patient. And so I have a herniated disc in my back. And so I've wrestled through doubts in a lot of ways of if God's ability to get things done. But working with students, I've been working with college students for over 21 years. A couple of years ago, I had a couple of students come to me on a summer mission that I was on and communicate to me that's a bunch of the doubts that they were experiencing because they had taken a religion class and their professor had seemingly shot a bunch of holes in Christianity. And so they were very confused. And I realized very quickly that a lot of students were wrestling with this. And so that combined with my brother-in-law, my wife's youngest brother, had what he called a spiritual deconstruction journey that lasted over the course of several years. And talking with him about that right around the same time that I thought was a lot of students were wrestling with this. And so I said, what would I want to read if I were a younger person, and what would help me in the process of doubting to do it well, as opposed to kind of fading away from my faith slowly over time. So that was kind of the genesis of it.
And I love what you say in your book, that it's not really a question of if we'll doubt, but when. And right. You've obviously touched on this a little bit, but are there sort of, do you see a pattern of doubts? Is it the same doubts that come up with the people that you're dealing with, or do they seem to be completely different depending on what it is that they're going through?
Yeah, I would hesitate to say that it's the same thing over and over. I will say that our culture now has fostered an environment where it's very popular and kind of celebrated to doubt, as opposed to there being like one thing specifically. Granted, there are several things that come up pretty regularly. The authority of the Bible, can we trust it? Is it really God's word? Is one that's pretty popular. And then, did Jesus really rise from the dead? And I actually, you know, my book is not an apologetics book per se. I do handle a little bit of that in one chapter specifically, talking about the resurrection. But I think that it's just a lot of issues that people wrestle with and struggle with. And then as a result, because the culture kind of fosters and celebrates that idea of like, yeah, it's great to question. You should definitely dive deeper into those things. And while I don't necessarily disagree with that, there's a difference between expecting that you will doubt and then celebrating doubt. Because when you celebrate it, you start to become obsessed with it, and it becomes kind of your primary means of processing all information about God and spiritual things and stuff.
I suppose some of the things that you've touched on there, whether the Bible's reliable, all of that, they're quite intellectual doubts, I suppose, aren't they, for want of a better word. Do you find that people also, as well as the intellectual doubts, are there people whose doubts are much more personal, heartfelt, I suppose, about the character of God? And I guess some of the things that you were touching on around pain and suffering, do they seem to outweigh the intellectual, or is it a kind of mixture of both in your experience?
In my experience, oddly enough, in higher education, it starts with more emotional stuff. It starts with more personal stuff, and then people start to dive into things, or a professor will shoot something out there, and or they'll have a conversation on campus, and it's an environment where people are encouraged to ask questions and encouraged to learn and grow. But I'd say that most of the people that I talk to, it ends up being something that like they hear something or they read something or they see something online, and it begins to coincide with an experience that they've had personally before. And those two kind of come together to form a perfect storm, for lack of a better phrase. And then that just sends them down the rabbit hole in a number of different ways. And so what I really wanted to achieve with the book is to say kind of what you had mentioned, that it's not really a matter of if you will doubt, it's really a matter of when. And so what can we do to prepare ourselves in a healthy way when doubt comes? Because life is going to be hard. Like, it's going to eventually smack you in the face in one form or another. And if you're not prepared spiritually to be able to dive into the difficult issues that you wrestle with, that you will wrestle with in the future, you're going to be thrown for more of a loop than you need to be.
And I thought you had quite a helpful differentiation in your book where you talk about the fact that doubt is not the same as unbelief. Would you just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, doubt is not the same as unbelief in the sense that, and kind of the parallel that I make with that is that temptation is not the same thing as sin. Temptation can lead to sin, just like doubt can lead to unbelief, but they are not equivalent to one another. So unbelief is something that is an intentional decision that someone makes to say, for example, there is no God, or God is not good, or the Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. Those are conclusions that someone reaches. Doubt is a process that people can wrestle with on a very regular basis. And the way I kind of like to equate it is if you consider doubt to be a little bit like a house guest who comes over to your home. When a house guest comes over to your place, they're sleeping on the couch, they're using your bathroom, they're putting dishes in the sink, they're kind of messing things up at the flow of your life. But then at the end of the weekend, they're always meant to pack up their stuff and leave. That's what doubt is supposed to be like in our lives. Doubt can come in and it can shake things up in our lives for a bit, but they're always meant to leave. If doubt were to set up pitch a tent in your living room and stay permanently, that would be abnormal. And so that's what I try to communicate to a believer, is that it's abnormal to obsess over these things and to constantly question these things, but it can come in, it can mess things up for a little bit, and then pack up and leave. And in reality, we are the better for it. Just like working out a muscle in a gym, when you break it down, it builds up back stronger. And doubt has the ability to do that with our faith.
There's a brilliant phrase, which again, you touched on it just there, but you say in your book that unbelief is a conclusion that someone reaches. It's a deliberate decision to live as if there is no God. And I suppose we've kind of seen that, haven't we, with lots of Christians, it seems, particularly this year, have sort of quite famously lost their faith. We've had quite a few of those on the show on Unbelievable. We've had Joshua Harris, John Steingard. Do you think doubt has played a huge part in that, or are there many other things in their deconversion? For want of a better word.
Right. I think it varies depending on the person. And I think that doubt, what I've seen, and this is why I wanted to write the book, is that I've concluded that people are not handling their doubts in the appropriate way. And so what normally happens in the context of at least college students is that they'll have a doubt, they'll something will kind of jostle them a bit, whether intellectually or emotionally, and then they'll kind of keep it to themselves and they won't actually like process it in a healthy way. And they just kind of start to fade into the background and walk away from their faith slowly over time. And so I know of several people who have done this. You know, I used to work with two of these guys who are a little bit more famous online, Rhett and Link. They were on staff with Crew, the organization I work for several years. I worked them a very long time ago over the course of this conference that we did together. And
they're YouTubers now, aren't they?
They're YouTubers. They kind of got on the YouTube train very early, and it worked out really well for them. They end up leaving staff and going into the entertainment business full time. And it was just mostly, you know, they were doing family entertainment stuff that's just funny and wholesome. And then recently, about a year or two ago, I saw a couple of things they were putting out there on social media. And I was like, I wonder if they're doing okay spiritually. And then they released this 4-part podcast of the spiritual deconstruction of both of their faiths. And so as a result of that, since I knew them a long time ago, I don't know them now, just to be clear, I haven't communicated with them in several years. But I felt like, you know, their audience speaks to a lot of the audience that I minister to. And so I felt like I had a unique opportunity to be able to communicate something. So I wrote an article, just a simple article on my really poorly trafficked website, and it ended up going viral. I've never gone viral before. It's actually not that great. People are pretty mean out there, but you know, I felt like it was what I needed to do to speak to it. And it was just some red flags that I saw in their spiritual deconstruction. And so as a result, people have asked me a lot of questions about it. I've kind of got thrown into the limelight right before the lockdown happened in the US. And there's nothing like a world altering pandemic to push you out of the news cycle. So I got out pretty quick, but consequently I've had lots of great opportunities to talk to people about it. And when they talked about it, it was wrestling with these questions and these doubts and just kind of obsessing over them. I saw that happen with kind of both of them. And I remember their personalities and kind of how they dealt with stuff. And so no doubt there was a lot of doubt in both of their lives, and they dealt with it in ways that led eventually to what they call, you know, unbelief. They call it hopeful agnosticism, which when you think about it, doesn't really mean anything.
So I suppose in a nutshell, what were some of the responses that you gave on that blog? And I guess if they were in front of you now, what would you want to tell them?
Well, you know, I did never expect that they would actually read the article. I know now I'm 99.9% sure that they actually have, because there's been a few people who are close to them to reach out to me and talk to me about it. But if I were to be in front of them, I would respectfully disagree with a lot of things that they said. And they're really great at being able to predict the kind of responses a person will have when they talk about their deconstruction. And so I don't know if that's, you know, training over the years of being online and being YouTube famous and saying those kind of things, but they're really good at saying, you're going to ask me this and you're going to say this. But if I were to talk to them and say what I could to them, I'd ask them to reconsider the deconstruction that they made as being more of a deconstruction of the Christian culture that they grew up in. And then I would also ask them to consider if you genuinely believe that becoming a Christian at God transforming your heart is a miracle. It's a gift of grace. There's really no such thing as spiritual as Christian deconstruction. There's no such thing as that, because if you believe that God, you know, spiritually reaches into your heart and pulls out a heart of stone and replaces it with a heart of flesh, that is a miracle. It's a gift of grace. It's nothing that you do. It's all on his side. That is not, it's not possible to deconstruct that, because it's a gift of grace. So if you tell me, you know, I believed, I did this, I read this, I said this, I shared my faith, I prayed, he was real to me, but now he's not, this sounds like a list of the things that you did in order to become a Christian. It sounds like works to me as opposed to grace. So I would really double click on, for lack of a better phrase, my Reformed theology and talk to them about what it means to be a Christian. What does it actually mean to be a Christian? Is it a miracle? If it is, which it is, God doesn't undo miracles like that. So I would really encourage them to consider those kind of things, those kinds of questions. But I don't think they want to talk to me.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about practical ways to deal with doubt in a second. But firstly, you list quite a lot of examples in your book about how doubt is biblical. So you sort of lay out some of the Bible characters that wrestle with doubts, which is really helpful. So how are some of the ways that we doubt well in a way that doesn't lead to unbelief?
Yeah, so biblically, the examples that I use are from the Old Testament. I mean, it's all over the place, but in the Old Testament, the Psalms, I ran across this quote from a pastor who said, the Psalms give us permission to beat on God's chest. And I really love that kind of visceral imagery of what it looks like. Because when you read the Psalms, they often live outside the pocket of where normal range of human emotion exists. They're either like really negative or really, really positive. And that, if anything, helps us to understand that, hey, this is a normal human thing. It's okay to wrestle with doubt. And then the New Testament example, doubting Thomas is the obvious one, and I get to him eventually, but the primary example I used was John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. John the Baptist was the precursor to the Messiah. He was the one who said, "Behold, the Lamb of God, it takes away the sin of the world." He was the one who baptized Jesus. And when he did, the skies opened up and an audible voice came from heaven that said, "This is my son." You would think that nobody would really question that. But yet at the end of his life, he's in prison. He sends a few of his disciples to Jesus and says, "Are you the one, or should we expect another?" And some people might read that and go, "Really? I mean, for crying out loud, you baptized Jesus and you heard the audible voice of God come from the sky and say, this is the one, and yet you're still doubting?" But I read that kind of thing and I'm like, well, I guess I'm in good biblical company. If John the Baptist can doubt and he heard God's voice, that gives me permission to doubt. And so I want to talk about in the book, not just like the ethereal, it's okay to do that, but give someone practical examples of how to deal with it in a healthy way. And so there's a number of different ways that I feel like are kind of practical strategies to fight back against doubt. One of them is practicing thankfulness in general. That's something that at least Western people don't do that much. And so when you're intentionally thankful for the blessings that you have around you, it's really difficult for thankfulness and a spirit of doubt to occupy the same space for a long period of time. So that's one of the things I talk about. One of them is to get with real and the right people. So again, I touched on this earlier, but like if you're going to be isolated in the process of doubt, you're just going to get killed. You're going to get picked off spiritually. Satan loves to go after the stragglers who are on their own. And so if you're doubting and you're questioning in the context of a healthy, authentic Christian community where you feel safe to ask those kind of questions, lean on others around you and be in community, that's going to do nothing but help you. So get with the right people. One of them is, preach the gospel to yourself every single day, every single hour, every single minute. The longer I've been a believer, the longer, the more and more I've realized that the gospel isn't just something that we share for people who don't believe. It is for me every waking moment. I need to remind myself, because humans, if anything, are extremely forgetful. So preach the gospel to yourself. And then I encourage people to preach the gospel to others. It's really difficult to continually live in doubt when you're sharing your faith with others. just like a teacher knows the material better than the students, you're able to dive into the gospel in a lot more healthy way. And as you're communicating it with other people and encouraging them to believe. And so that combined with like good orthodox reading and being intentional. So those students that I ran into that one time, they asked me a bunch of questions. I asked them, have you read this? This was answered nicely in this. And they were like, oh, I don't know who that is. And I'm like, guys, you just need to put in the work, because the questions that you think are unique to you have actually been asked for thousands of years. You just got to be willing to put in the work to actually go find some quality answers to stuff. And now with the internet age, stuff has never been more available. So don't be lazy about it, because if this is a matter of life and death, and it is, like, put in the work, go find the answers, and they're there.
I suppose on the flip side of that, one of the things that you say in the book is it's different knowing about God to knowing God personally. And I suppose, how do we do that? Because I guess it's one thing going and reading all those things and learning about God, but how do we sort of actively cultivate that personal relationship with God so that becomes easier?
Yeah. And that's really what I saw happening with my brother-in-law in this whole process, is that when he started to really slip quite a bit, he ended up writing this like short little manifesto about what he believed and what he did not believe anymore. And he communicated to me like, these are the things that I've done. These are the things that I genuinely believed, and now I don't anymore. And I found like a theme in there, even with Rhett and Link too, is that they knew a lot about God. They knew the culture. They knew the Bible verses. They knew how people would pray. They'd know the jokes about the culture. They'd know how to mock different things, which we all do all the time. But like, if you're entrenched in the culture, you can start to recognize that this is a cultural thing, that I know a lot about God, but do I actually know him? Has my heart been transformed? Am I actually born a second time, as opposed to knowing a lot about him? And I think the danger here in knowing a lot about him can be often substituted for an authentic relationship with him. And so when you come to the end of your life, it's not going to be like, if Jesus, you know, says, away from me, I never knew you, you could say, but I prayed the prayer, but I knew the Bible verses, but I shared my faith. It's not like, away from me, I never like understood what Christianity was. It's not that. It's, away from me, I never knew you. And so, do you actually know God, or do you just know a lot about him? And the way I kind of equivalent that is that if you're a single person and you're living in the world today of online dating and all that kind of stuff, you can swipe right a couple of times on a dating app and then start to stalk that person, because that's authentically what happens. You can start to look up and you can learn a lot of things about that person, like what their favorite foods are, what they listen to, their style, blah, blah, blah. You can know a lot about them, but until you actually meet them and engage in a relationship with them, you don't really know that person. So if you know a lot of things about me based on my social media profiles, and then you and I meet and you assume that you know who I am, I'm going to be offended by that, because you don't actually have a relationship with me. Do you know a lot about me? That's great. That's part of the picture. But until you actually are in relationship with me and you know me, that's a totally different relationship. In fact, those are two like worlds apart from one another. Knowing a lot about God is not the same as actually knowing God. And I think every Christian needs to really wrestle with that, knowing whether or not they actually know a ton about him, or do they actually know him. And so when I see that with people like, you know, Joshua Harris, Rhett and Link, even my brother-in-law, it sounds to me like you knew a lot about God, but you never really knew him. And of course, I don't know that God knows their hearts. And I'm not going to arrogantly kind of pompously say that. I know I would be accused of that if I said those kind of things, because it's very offensive, especially in today's culture. But it's just what the Bible communicates. It's not about knowing about him. It's actually being in relationship with him.
I don't know whether this is the same in the States, but in the UK, certainly nowadays, it's quite a commonplace thing for youth groups and student groups to be a place where people can bring their questions and discuss things and come with those difficult questions. Whereas maybe 20, 30 years ago in youth groups, you were just sort of told to maybe don't worry about the questions, just believe, just have faith, perhaps even leave your brain at the door when you come into the youth groups. Right. Why do you think we were like that? Why do you think we were so sort of down on doubts and trying to squash people's questions and doubts?
I think a lot of it had to do with fear. I think if people start to ask questions about stuff, we immediately jump to, well, they're going to get to a certain space in their mind and it's going to lead their heart away from God. And so there's fear with that of, like, granted, you know, the culture shifts all the time. And I think I grew up in kind of the 90s culture, and that's definitely what the vibe was. It was like, just believe this. Don't question it. This is what's right. Therefore, you don't have the right to be able to explore what is quote unquote wrong. And so that mentality, I've noticed this as a parent. My kids are young. I have a 9 and a 7-year-old, and I feel like even when they ask a bunch of questions that I don't know the answer to, I need to fake it and pretend like I do know what the answer is. But that is really unhealthy as a parent. I think that if people have questions now, and you're a youth group leader or a pastor or even a parent, and your kids ask you questions and you don't know the answer to the question, don't fake it, because if you do, that will come up again. As much as the stuff that we swept under the rug in early parts of ministry when I was doing it, of like, don't ask questions. Like you said, check your brain at the door. It's fine. Just believe. That has come up and bitten us now in our current culture, because like I said, when life gets hard, we will ask those questions again. And then if there haven't been solid answers that were given to us, we'll quickly deconstruct the Christian culture that we grew up in. And that will lead to really dangerous places in our faith now. So I think if like I said, if you're a leader or you're a parent and you don't know the answer to a question, a good answer is, I don't know. Let's find out together. Because again, you could find the answers. There's satisfying answers to the questions that people throw out there and go, well, what about this? And it's like, that question's been asked for a long time. I'm not sure what that answer is. Let's go find out together, not just with reading, but I mean, the way that YouTube and the stuff that's posted out there, I've learned a ton in my faith theologically just by going to search out the right answers for things. So find out the answers, but don't pretend like you know everything.
As a dad and someone who's been working with students for 20 years, how do you respond to those statistics that talk about young people leaving the church in droves, I guess, particularly when they get to the end of high school? Do you think they're leaving the church, or do you think they're leaving their faith? Because I suppose it's one thing if they're leaving the kind of constructed church, but they still have a faith of their own and they're pursuing it in different ways. So I guess it's twofold, that question. Do you think they're leaving their faith? If so, what are some of those big reasons, do you think, for that?
Well, I mean, you could dive into the theology of it and say, are they leaving their faith? Well, if they never had a faith in the first place, they're not actually leaving their faith. But I think that it comes down to authenticity in what you communicate from the pulpit or what you're communicating in youth group, and then living the exact same way. I found that hypocrisy is not dealt with very well. Like, people don't respond to hypocrisy well, even more so, exponentially more so today. So if you're communicating something publicly, like I said, either from the pulpit or in the youth group, and your life does not reflect what you actually communicate from your sermons or your messages, your talks or whatever, people are quick to sniff that out. And when they get to a spot where they're leaving from high school and going to college or out in the working force or whatever, they'll quickly go, well, they never actually really believed that. And if they didn't believe that, what's the point? How is this going to work for me if the person who's supposed to be the professional Christian, the pastor or whatever, how is this ever going to work for me if a person who spends their life preaching about it doesn't really work for them too? So I think there's a combination between several factors, and it needs to be intentional communication from upfront about what the Bible actually communicates, so good theology that's communicated and how that's applicable to our lives, and then living it out as well, so that we don't get certain things like hypocrisy, people walking away from their faith, hipster Christianity that's only popular because it's mirroring what the world thinks is great, that kind of stuff. Is there life change communicated and then actually lived with our leaders? I think that's a big factor.
If you could go back to your teenage self, knowing everything that you've kind of learned along the way, is there anything that you would tell yourself? I suppose, particularly in the area of doubt and unbelief and things like that.
Yeah, I would say to myself, life is not going to go the way that you think it will. So I would say, you know, I mentioned I struggle with chronic pain. That's never something that I would have picked for myself off of a list as a way to become more sanctified and more Christ-like. I wouldn't have said, yeah, physical pain, I'll pick that one. But it has been, you know, the way that God has worked in my heart the most significantly. I have been able to see Jesus in ways that I never would have before. So to say, hey, when that happens, you're going to doubt pretty significantly in what you actually believe. Your faith is going to be tested in ways that you never thought were possible. So grace, rely on God's grace. It is about him working in your life. And he, as he works, when you're in his hands, if he's a bad God, an evil God, a sadistic God, or if he's not sovereign, you should be terrified. But he's not any of those things. He's a good God. He's a loving God. He's a sovereign God. He knows exactly what he's doing. Your view of him is quite small right now. It will grow, but stay rooted in the fact that God's grace is what will make you who you are. It will transform your life, and it will help you to understand who Jesus was in ways that you never thought were possible. And to become more Christ-like is a good thing. It's always a good thing.
How do we find out more about Shelby Abbott and your book, Doubtless?
It's on Amazon, of course, like every other book in the universe. But you can my website is just shelbyabbott.com, ABBOTT, and my books are there. My blog is there. It's not a super flashy website, but you can find some stuff there about what I'm doing and some of the writing that I've done in the past.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Ruth. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Unbelievable, bringing you a variety of interviews this week with interesting people, and you can find more on Shelby's book from today's show and at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Coming up next, final part of this week's show, my conversation with Mark Clark on the problem of Jesus. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Not our usual discussion debate format this week. We've been bringing you a series of interviews and our final one coming up in a moment's time. If you'd like another great interview tonight at 8 p.m. on The Profile, well, Ruth Jackson is back. She's talking to Frith Robb about her story of converting from Islam to Christianity. That's on The Profile tonight at 8, and you can find it on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And we're keeping Ruth busy because actually she'll be in the hot seat next week for Unbelievable for a show looking again at this issue of doubt, this time with UK Christian leader Ben Jack. He heads up Advance with the Message Trust, and he's the author of a new book, My Lord and My God, which is all about the issue of doubt. He'll be in conversation with ex-Christian Logan Walker, who was himself in youth ministry here in the UK until relatively recently, talking about Logan's deconstruction journey and the pressures facing young people on that front. So a really important, I think, that we have these kinds of conversations. I think that's really where a lot of the issues are today when it comes to the Christian atheist discussion. So look out for that on next week's edition of Unbelievable. Just want to update you before we go to the final part of today's show on your generosity when it comes to our Compassion partnership. Several weeks ago, we featured that conversation with Richmond Wandera, a pastor in Uganda, and he has benefited from being lifted out of poverty himself by Compassion as a child and able to now be a leading theologian and pastor in East Africa. Well, thanks to your sponsorship, we're now at 90 children sponsored through the show via compassion. So just one last call for this. We'd love to just cross the line to 100 if at all possible. If you've been thinking about sponsoring through the show, do go to the link compassion.com/Justin and sponsor a child through The Unbelievable Show. It'd be great to reach 100, wouldn't it? And anyone in the US sponsoring also gets a copy of my book as well with their sponsorship. So if that helps, then compassion.com/Justin. We'd love to see 100 children sponsored. Another thing, just for your diary, you may be aware that I often speak at the UK Christian festival Spring Harvest each Easter. I often deliver apologetics seminars. Well, this year, of course, it's all online. And the theme is Unrivaled, Why We Worship. It's not too late to get yourself booked in. It's all happening in the week immediately after Easter, over Easter weekend and the week after Easter. Springharvest.org, if you'd like to get yourself signed up for all the online sessions that Spring Harvest are doing this year. My own teaching on the subject of worship, because that's the theme, Unrivaled, Why We Worship. I'll be doing some teaching on why six reasons why we're made to worship, and I'll be hosting a live after hours seminar panel on Tuesday the 6th of April in the evening. I'll be hosting a conversation on whether we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19. Going to be joined by gospel artist Moiwa, worship leader Tim Hughes, and others. So if you want to register for this year's online Spring Harvest, springharvest.org. Certainly not too late to do that. And of course, you can join us for our own event and conference in May, Saturday the 15th of May, unbelievable.live for the Unbelievable Conference. Looking forward to be joined by N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, and some other great guests, co-hosted by myself and Ruth Jackson. Well, just before we go to the final interview of the show, just going to squeeze in one little bit of feedback. Last week, great conversation on whether there's a cancel culture on university campuses, looking at the case of Julia Rinkovich, and who was supporting pro-life causes, and that caused her to be suspended from her midwifery course. Lots of interesting feedback to this. Just this one from Sarah came in that I wanted to share. Who says, I really appreciated that episode. I was in graduate school in the US, one of the largest state schools, from 2000 to 2002. And this episode spoke to me directly because my small contingent of friends and I, who were Christians, found ourselves in a greatly hostile environment in our social work program. Even back then, we all kept quiet for the most part in our program and on campus. We didn't feel free or safe to speak our experience, our thoughts, or our truth through the program. There were direct statements and even discussions about whether or not someone who considers themselves a Christian should, and I quote, even be allowed to become licensed social workers. This didn't stop my friends or I from becoming licensed social workers and enjoying a long career in the field, but that experience was both shocking and traumatic at the time, and even now is uncomfortable to recollect. I appreciated the conversation you facilitated on your podcast, as it helped me to realise just how complex this issue is. In a country where free speech is touted as primary and essential to our society and government, it certainly doesn't come without a cost. I've been properly challenged as to the importance of helping others engage in conversation around free speech. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah, for getting in touch. Great to hear that. And yes, your comments still welcome on last week's programme on whether there's a cancel culture on university campuses. Right now, time for the final part of the show as I talk to Mark Clark about Jesus.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
In this part of the show, Mark Clark, pastor of the Village Church in Vancouver, joins me. He's author of The Problem of God and most recently, The Problem of Jesus, answering skeptics' challenges to the person of Jesus. And it's great to have you with us on the show today. Thank you, Mark, for talking to me.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, brother.
I was out in your church, believe it or not, about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I just had such a great time, such lovely people. We unfortunately, you were not around at that point, you know, you were traveling, but I got to speak at the church. I mean, tell us about the church, because it's multi-site, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know that
everyone wanted to hire you by the time I got back. I almost lost my job. So that was the end of that. So we started out 2010 in a little elementary school. Actually in my house, 16 people kind of got together. I was working at a church, and the church very graciously said, yeah, why don't you take 30 total and try to start something 35 minutes up the road. And so I was like, okay. So we just started talking to people like Jesus. I was a skeptic, grew up in a skeptical home. So it was kind of geared towards skeptics, trying to reach, you know, people in the greater Vancouver area. And it started to kind of grow and grow. People started to meet Jesus and people started bringing their friends and, you know, life change started to happen, which is, you know, addictive. And people started spreading the word and it got, you know, crazy. So anyway, it grew and grew. And so we had to go to a bigger site and go to multiple services and then two sites, three sites, you know, whatever. So yeah, we are multi-site now, and we have sites in Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, and Toronto. So, wow. and then of course online stuff. So yeah, God's been doing a cool thing across Canada. So yeah. It's cool to see, you know, people excited about Jesus.
It's very, very exciting. How has COVID hit you guys though? I mean, obviously it's different for different churches in different parts.
What's COVID?
World. Doesn't exist in Canada apparently.
No, I don't know what you're talking about. We just hang out in our house anyway all the time. Yeah, man, it's been crazy. So because we rent all of our facilities as a church, we don't own a building yet. We've been shut down since March. We've not been able to get together. Everything shifted to online. Wow. Yeah, all of our sites are like movie theaters and performing arts centers. And so here we are, 11 years old, you know, thousands of people, and we're all just sitting in our houses, you know, waiting to go back to church kind of thing. So, but it's been, we shifted online and we've actually grown a bunch, and the online audience, you know, and it's become a little bit more of a global scene. You know, you got people from all over the place who are like, they're like, well, this is our church now. And they're coming to our classes and wanting to become members and giving and coming to community groups. And so it's shifted a bit of our attention where we're actually growing faster online than we are, you know, in the physical locations. You're like, oh yeah, we should probably spend some time and money actually using this as the tip of the spear of evangelism. So,
yeah, I guess I'm sure looking forward to being able to resume some kind of in-person.
Yeah. Oh man. Eventually. It's, you don't get into this job to stare at a cameraman.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As great as he is.
The good news is everyone's in the same boat, and I've spoken to countless pastors who have had to do the same job of navigating an entirely unprecedented, unforeseen situation. But, but it's good to hear that the church has nevertheless been trying to use it as far as possible. Yeah. Tell us about yourself though. You were an adult convert, weren't you?
Yeah.
Tell us what kind of home you grew up in, how you kind of eventually bumped into God and became a Christian.
Yeah. So my dad, the way I kind of illustrate this, my dad was such an ardent atheist. I have an older brother, named Matthew. And he said, you know, I'll let us spell his name. I'll let him call us Matthew, but we got to spell it with one T because I don't want to spell it, you know, like the Bible. And then 4 years later, they had me and called me Mark. So clearly this guy had never picked up a Bible, because he's trending in the wrong direction. And so he, you know, this was the home, no Bible, no church, no prayer, no nothing. And then, when I was, my parents divorced and a bunch of stuff went down. And when I was, late high school, like grade 12, a guy told me about Jesus, and I just started investigating of course I'm doing everything a guy does in high school with his life, you know? So I'm sitting out reading my Bible in front of my high school, smoking a pack of cigarettes, just trying to learn. And then gave my life to Jesus. And to be honest, I had this crazy, you know, conversion experience where he just got a hold of my life, totally transformed, you know, not what I do, but what I want to do. And I started just telling everybody about, I was like, well, everyone needs to know. So I'd be sitting out, guys would be hammered at the park. I'd be telling them about Jesus, smoking my cigarettes. I'd be baptizing guys at 2 o'clock in the morning. And before I was ever baptized, I never walked to a church yet, you know? So this is bad. Yeah.
Let me get this straight, but are you saying you kind of had a conversion experience just from reading the Bible?
And a guy telling me, like bringing me to that point.
Yeah.
And then kind of discipling me a little bit in the theology, but just at high school, as we walked around, like there was no, I had no formal leadership. I had, which might explain a lot. You know, I didn't have any kind of reverence for church in that sense. I was just kind of whatever. So, you know, I just, you know, met. So I went from the guy sitting in a garage smoking pot with his buddies, you know, whatever. And now 3 weeks later, I'm in the same garage telling them, I mean, I'm high because they're all smoking pot still, but I'm telling them about Jesus, you know? And so anyway, that was my life. So I started going to Bible college and the rest is history. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fascinating backstory to this. Really enjoyed the book as well. Now, look, I'm going to be honest with you here, Mark. I thought, oh, Mark, yeah, he's pastors a big church. He's probably kind of done a kind of Jesus for Seekers kind of, you know, this is sort of the packaged version, if you know what I mean, of Jesus. Sure. And when I actually sat down and read the book, I thought, no, this is like properly scholarly. And I realized, of course, that you actually at some point you were even thinking of pursuing scholarship, weren't you? Before you kind of went into church leadership. So, this has kind of been the result of, I'm guessing, quite a lot of thinking, research, reading, but it's done in a very accessible way, which is great. So what's behind the book? Who's it for, and what can people expect when they read it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I came from, I moved out to Vancouver from Toronto to pursue a master's degree out here at Regent College. And then I was going to come over to you guys and try to do a PhD, you know, and so that was the plan. And then I, you know, I wrote my master's degree, a master's thesis on Romans 9 to 11, which of course, you know, there's no shortage of things. And after I was done that, I was like, hey, let's go PhD. And the Lord was like, no, I want you to plant this church. And, you know, I love academic. I love sometimes, you know, being a pastor for me is like, I love footnotes. I love sitting in a library with me in words because they don't cheat on their wives. They don't, you know, they don't drink too much. They're not a gong show, you know? So I'm like, oh man, people are the worst. Why am I going to pastor them? So anyway, so I gave up the scholarship dream, and did, you know, obviously continue in it, but try to bring it into the real world every week and watch it live in the lives of people. And that's, you know, there's something about that you can't get away from once you see it start to really impact people's lives. So
I mean, I was going to ask though, like, you know, when you move from the scholarship, you know, sitting in the library and reading, you know, the Victory of the Son of God or whatever from N.T. Wright, you know, 1,000+ pages, and you're moving like to talking to someone who maybe just walked across the threshold of your church, which is what you're doing a lot of the time with the village church. How does that level of scholarship translate into what you actually say to someone who may not even really know anything about Jesus?
Yeah. Well, what I found is obviously, you know, as a preacher, you can't bring everybody into the library with you. You got to go in yourself and then come out, dust yourself off and tell them what you found, and then tell them what it has to do with the fact that what are they thinking about, right? Like, one of the things that people forget is, especially in our cultures, people aren't just wondering if Christianity is true. They're wondering whether it works. Does it work to change my marriage? Because my marriage is a gong show. My kids are a gong show. My budget's a gong show. My work sucks. I hate my boss. That's what most people are dealing with. And we get up and let's talk about, you know, and it's like, well, no, you got to bring what you found in there and then make it live in their life. And so, anyway, I have found that, you know, if you do the hard work yourself and then bring it out and kind of show them the tip of the iceberg, what they want to do is they know that there's more underneath. They can sense it when you're preaching, you know, they're going, okay, he's got something here and he's giving it to me, you know, he's giving me kind of the tip here. And then what I found is people, once they start engaging those ideas, the big thing that happens is they start to go, right, I never thought of it that way before. Mm-hmm. Oh, I never thought of it. So that's what scholarship has done for me. It's been able to kind of take an angle on something that maybe the regular Joe, even the regular Joe who grew up in church, maybe they never thought of this. And now let me spin it for them that way. And then let me unpack what it has to do with their life. So anyway, that's...
And that's why, I mean, we're talking here about the problem of Jesus, which is subtitled Answering Skeptics' Challenges. But I do get the sense that it's written as much for Christians who want to kind of understand the person of Jesus more than perhaps they have. Because I think a lot of Christians grow up with a certain idealized church view of Jesus. And I think even, you know, in the opening chapters, you kind of ask some significant questions about how we got the Bible, how it represents the words of Jesus, some uncomfortable things that some Christians won't have realized of how the Bible came together and how we understand the kind of genre of the stories of Jesus' life, the Gospels and so on. So in a way, you're kind of, I feel like you're asking Christians to reconsider the way they think about Jesus as a historical person, as much as you're hoping to answer some of the skeptical challenges too.
I tried to look, because of my background, I tried to fuse together both those worlds. How do you write a book for skeptics and believers that are going to challenge the skeptic to say, you know, Jesus is the best idea in the marketplace of ideas. And then the believer who thinks they know Jesus, you know, like in the introduction where I talk about, you know, the scandal, the confrontation, we pitch him as Mr. Rogers meets Tony Robbins or whatever. Right. And it's like, who would have killed that guy? Nobody. You know, oftentimes we make Jesus in our own image and he's nothing but some, you know, pithy sayings, nice little things he's talking about, telling heavenly, earthly stories with heavenly meanings, all this kind of, and it's like, he dies as a revolutionary against the empire. You know, he's Luke Skywalker, man. He's fighting the empire. He's not walking around just talking about seeds and birds. I mean, when he is, these are subversive stories.
Yeah.
This isn't just nice little stories to knit on a thing. This is like real. Yeah. I got to reframe God, salvation, Israel, the kingdom, yourself, joy. Yeah. I'm redefining everything you knew about everything. And you're going to either accept it or you're going to deny it. But there's not this middle of the road option of, well, Jesus is cool. He's a nice guy. He's a good leader. He's, you know, he's an archetype for sacrifice and love. And it's like, that's not a thing.
Yeah. That's okay. So moving from sort of maybe some of the unhelpful impressions that Christians sometimes pick up from Christian culture, even about Jesus, what are the kind of the key objections you encounter from skeptics when it comes to, when you start to talk to them about Jesus? I mean, do you find they also suffer from a pretty, you know, poor understanding picture of Jesus?
Yeah, I think both. I think you see a generation of people right now who are are leaving the church, right? And they're leaving it sometimes for the same reason skeptics never came into it. And it's like, there's stuff that I don't like about the hypocrisy of the church or Christian nationalism or racism or sexuality, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, what I try to do is like, okay, let's clear away some of that. And actually let's just look at Jesus, because don't reject Christianity based on Christians trying to, and just fumbling to try to follow Jesus. You got to clear away that and look at Jesus. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book. What if when we actually look at him, you know, he doesn't carry any of that. It's Christians trying to follow him. And, you know, there's this concept that I talk to my church about often, because I deal with a lot of people who want to leave the church. And I think it was Solzhenitsyn gave an image years ago where he talked about if I'm trying to find my way home, and I say, where is it? And you point down a pathway, but I'm walking along it drunkenly. It doesn't mean it's the wrong way. It just means I'm hammered, you know? And so it's like, don't reject the way because Christians are, you know, fumbling along the path, you know? Yeah. So I find that skeptics and Christians are denying Jesus based on stuff that has nothing to do with Jesus. It has to do with a bad version of Christianity that we've come up with after 2000 years of doing our best to figure this thing out.
Yeah.
And so let's clear that away and deal with, okay, what is he saying? What is he calling us to?
Yeah. Well, you do such a good job in the book of kind of dealing with the kind of historical case for Jesus and being very upfront about what the limitations are as well of what we can know, but the way we're meant to understand and the way this has been dealt with in the church historically. But I suppose, you know, a lot of that leads me, particularly for the skeptic, to say, okay, so you've got, say, a skeptic who's kind of intrigued by the person of Jesus. Maybe they did grow up with some misconceptions, and the book manages to clear some of those up. But kind of what, how much do you need to know? How much kind of do you have to have kind of the historical evidence in place before you can kind of make, I suppose, you know, that leap of faith? And I don't want to kind of, I don't like, you know, the dichotomy between faith and reason. I think they go together, as I'm sure you do. But nonetheless, there's a point at which you have to say, I'm probably not going to have all the answers I want to everything, but I'm going to trust this. And how do you bring people to that point? What's the kind of thing that needs to happen to move it from just, I'm interested in the intellectual, historical Jesus to actually, this could be a real being who changes my life.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, as we've kind of been alluding to, you know, you got the, how are we going to know anything about him? It's going to be a gospels thing. Right. So can we trust, you know, when I first became a Christian, it was like, I just, you know, Augustine said, the Bible is the face of God for us now. And it's like, I really encountered Jesus in the scriptures. And I was like, so now we got to trust those. So I remember, you know, reading, there was a parable in Luke I read one day. And then I was like, I thought I read that in Matthew. And I went over to Matthew and I read it and I compared these two parables and there was differences in them. And I lost my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, these guys made this up. Because when Luke says it, there's two masters. And when Matthew said it, there was one or there was three birds. I forget the exact scenario, but the seeds or the birds or the masters, something was off. And I was like, forget it. And kind of, you know, and then I started, you know, and I talk about this in the book, I started, you know, actually reading scholars that pointed out the fact that Jesus, you gotta like, don't throw away Christianity based on your terrible 21st century ideas about what the gospel writer should be doing. This guy had a 3-year ministry. So he's walking around Galilee telling these stories. He probably told them 250 times. If you had a tape recorder, you would have taped him doing the one with the two masters and one took that one that he did on a Wednesday. And Luke took the one later. You know what? This is, we project all of these things. And I remember just, to be humble here, why am I projecting all my ideas about Christianity onto a text? These guys can formulate topics if they want. You know, you go to the Gospel of Mark, all of his parables are in chapter 4. We look, oh my goodness, I guess Mark's doing a thing here. It's like, no, that's what they were allowed to do. This was what the genre of first century biography that melded together, you know, Greco-Roman ideas and Jewish storytelling together in this thing where they were allowed to shift information around to make theological points. They were allowed to have all these things. So it caused me to go, okay, I got to take a breather here and judge this genre based on its thing, not my thing, projecting it on. And I find that skeptics, once you explain things like that to them,
a lot of the objections just kind of disappear, I find, at that point, because I think you're right, Mark, and I think the problem has been that the church has often held up a specific view of scripture that is, you know, it's easy then for a skeptic to shoot down because I'm just going to line up two passages and show that there's some kind of problem with that.
Right.
But it wasn't ever a problem to start with because, you know, that those were not the, you know, genre rules that they were interested in at that point. And I find a lot of those supposed contradiction things just go away the moment you realize there was this license to deal with the text in that way. Now, of course, the problem then for the skeptic is, well, is that shady? You know, is that like, does that suggest they were just making stuff up, basically?
Right.
If they were willing to reorganize and, you know, their material and so on. So where do you go with that?
So remember I'm in the book where I talked about Lewis, C.S. Lewis, and he says all these German scholars, you know, are like, oh, this is just romance literature. You know, these are just made up stories. And he's like, guys, I can't trust you because your German scholars who've only spent all this time in your life dealing with the Gospels. He's like, I've spent my whole life dealing with romance, you know, true mythology, and this ain't nothing like it. It's because you're too close to gospel study that I can't trust that you know right, because you've never read Beowulf in the original, you know, whatever. So I think, you know, I was watching, you get over there, The People versus O.J. Simpson. Have you ever seen? Okay,
yeah, I watched
you,
that,
Did you watch it? Okay,
yeah.
So here's what hit me the other day. So when you watch The People versus O.J. Simpson, of course, it's trying to tell this story about O.J. and his trial in 94 is when he, you know, when the murders happened. Okay, so, but the whole show opens with the beating of Rodney King and the subsequent, you know, protests and riots in L.A. in 92. And you're like, why are they starting the show with this? And it's because they're trying to give context politically, emotionally to the trial. It's saying, here's why this guy is going to end up being innocent in the end. Here's why jurors are going to find him, you know, they're going to say he can get off. Because the seemingly disconnected thing was the context of this trial. And I find this is what the gospel writers are doing. They're not just giving us information. They're giving us the meaning of the information. They're giving us the context of it. And that's why they can shift it around or do this or that. Like one of the examples, which obviously isn't that controversial, but I talk about how, you know, in John 3:16, we have them all red letters, and you know, Jesus, of course, says, for God so loved the world, you know, in most of our Bibles, but there was no red letters in the original. There was no quotation marks. And most scholars actually think by the time that text is said, that's just John's commentary on what Jesus has just said. Well, most people, oh my goodness, Jesus didn't say, for God so loved the world. It's like, no, John's saying it, you know. So it's really understanding that they have the ability and flexibility to do these things that, like you said, now some of the skepticism starts to go away, and we start to look and go, okay, I got to trust these documents is my point, coming back to your original question. And if we trust the documents, which I think we can based on archaeology and the leaders that they talk about and all the historical data that's been done on digging up coins that, you know, all of that, then we start to work backwards from, you know, things you talk about all the time, the resurrection and all that stuff. And if that stuff starts to ring true, now I gotta evaluate, what are the real reasons I'm rejecting this? What are the reasons behind the reasons? Is it because I'm, you know, like I like to say to my church on Easter, you know, my church doubles in size on Easter. And, you know, because a bunch of people show up that their family invited. And I love to challenge them a bit and say, look, here's the reason you're not going to come back here next week. Because, you know, you came here. I'm glad you put your nice slacks on. You came because grandma asked you to come, and you're going to go back and eat ham or whatever this afternoon, whatever you do. And that's great. But here's the problem. The reason that you're not going to believe in Jesus today is not because you're smarter than everybody in this room. It's because you're a coward. It's because you're afraid of what your coworker is going to say if you give your life to Jesus today, what your girlfriend's going to say, what your husband's going to say. That's why you won't believe. You want to hold on to your control in life. You want to hold on to what's comfortable for you and what you know. And what I'm trying to get at is, let's not all pretend skeptics are skeptics because they're just so much smarter than everybody else. There are reasons behind reasons. And I want to try to get at those and go, I'm not telling you this is what, I'm just telling you at least do some evaluation on yourself and evaluate your real reasons why you might be rejecting this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think the best skeptics are skeptical of their own skepticism in that sense. And they're willing to see that we all suffer from confirmation bias. We all have a worldview that we're not going to give up easily necessarily. And there's going to be, And I totally agree. I think what's often presented ostensibly as intellectual objections can often be being used as a sort of a mask for other kinds of actual, what the real objections often are underneath. But having said all that, you know, there's still a, you know, what we're inviting people to when we invite them to a relationship with Jesus is not a historical person exactly, is it? As much as we might want to show the historical foundations for this person, it is for something that is ultimately quite mysterious. So, and I think you deal with that quite well in the book, that we can't just rationalize everything. You know, we don't invite people into a kind of a rational thing,
right?
Ultimately, it's not right. Irrational, but it's not just some kind of logical, you know,
sure,
argument that well, people accept.
Yeah, it's I talk about a little bit in the parables chapter and the discipleship chapter, the concept of like this, we are what we love kind of idea, right? The at some level, we get changed, not just by cognitive information, but by our affections. That's actually the most powerful thing about us, right? Is the decisions we make in life are driven not by what's always true, but what glitters, what feels good. The, you know, and I talk about the concept, like the mall doesn't try to get you by your logic. It gets you by your gut, your feelings, right? And so Christianity needs to be able to, and it does, of course, appeal and fulfill that part of ourselves too, where it, at the end of the day, is about our joy. You know, Jesus is saying, I have a plan of how to make true joy in your life, not just for 80 years, but 80 billion. And the question is, are you willing to, during your 80, go, I'm not just a thinking creature. I make decisions. Look, I do a lot of, I've been a pastor for 20 years. Believe it or not, you know, looking at me. And when I do marriage counseling, I will sit with a couple and I'll do premarital counseling with them. And they will say, you know, and I'll be like, guys, you guys are not a good fit. And, you know, and she'll leave the room and I'll be like, dude, you know, you have nothing in common. And the guy goes, yeah, but she's hot. And these people get married, Justin. And the reason is because their brain is gone and their whole life is driven, as we all are, by our gut, by our, you know, affections, whatever. So anyway, all that to say, the great thing about Christianity is it's a fulfillment of our gut too. It's a fulfillment of that mysterious part of ourselves that's constantly looking for that meaning. And in the parables chapter, I talk about that a lot, about, you know, the reason Jesus, one of the big things Jesus did, he was known, James Dunn talks about this, as a parabolist. From a historical standpoint, what did Jesus do? He told stories all the time. Well, if all he's trying to do is appeal to our reason, just go forget, you know, when you go up the Sermon on the Mount, just spend the weekend, write a systematic, walk it down to us, hand it to us and go, this is what you're supposed to believe. Your ministry will be done in 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, but he doesn't do that. Mm. He tells stories about birds and seed and brothers that, you know, hate their dad. And it's like, why is he doing all this? Because he's trying to reframe not just our thinking, but our feeling and the way we live our life and the whole thing. And of course, the paradigm for Christianity and the Gospels is discipleship of Jesus as like your Lord and teacher. And so Christianity gets pitched as not this thing that you can just, hey, you have a different theology than your neighbor, but you still watch Netflix, spend your money, and do your sex life exactly the same as everybody else around you. It's like, that's not Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
In the New Testament, you know. So anyway, so I think we need that kind of like, okay, where does the mystery fit in? The mystery fits in. Now I start following Jesus and he's not physically here. So he's speaking to me through his words and he's speaking through me through his spirit. And he's, you know, the church and all of these great things. But in the end, you're right. There is a gap.
Yeah.
I think part of that gap, the brilliance of it is it keeps the heart trending.
Yeah.
And it keeps the heart grasping at just that thing. It's just on the edge. You can't quite, you know, and if it was like boop, complete here, done, it'd be like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it's been so good chatting with you, Mark. Thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me, sir. Appreciate it.
Delightful. I hope to bring you on Unbelievable, maybe for a full discussion with a skeptic at some point. That would be interesting to do. But for now, this has been a great introduction to the book. It's called The Problem of Jesus, Answering Skeptics' Challenges to the Person of Christ. And We'll make sure there's a link from today's show so you can get hold of it for yourself. All the best as you return to your pastoring, your virtual
thank
congregation
you,
at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark,
yeah. Thank
bless
you so much. Appreciate
yeah.
it.
Well, you can find links to Mark's book, along with all of the other guests that we've spoken to on today's show. Just go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And thank you so much for joining us for this week's special interview-laden edition of the show. And if you go to the show page, you can also find links to our Unbelievable conference. Do get yourself booked in for Saturday, the 15th of May. We'd love to see you there with all of the guests, seminars, Q&A that will be going on, helping you to live out your faith in a post-COVID world, how to tell the greatest story ever told to a new generation. Unbelievable.live to book your place. For now, let me finish by telling you what's coming up next week. Ruth Jackson is back, and she'll be talking about doubt, this time with UK Christian leader Ben Jack, who heads up Advance with the Message Trust and is the author of a new book, My Lord and My God. He'll be in conversation with ex-Christian Logan Walker, who was in youth ministry himself in the UK until relatively recently, and talking about Logan's deconstruction journey and the pressures that face young people on that front. These are important conversations. Hope you can join us for that one, same time next week. Until then, have a good week.